interview with George Christian, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N, September 17th, 1979.
Hello, George Christian?
Yes, sir.
Oh, this is David Culbert calling from Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. May I ask you a couple of questions now? Is this still convenient time, or I know you're leaving the country tomorrow.
Yeah, well, go ahead. Yeah, I'm kind of in a bind, but that's okay.
Okay, I'll try and keep these brief as I talk to your secretary. If these are things you don't remember anything about, don't want to waste your time.
Okay.
My first question, I'm interested in Vietnam and problems of television coverage of Vietnam, but I want to ask a couple of other questions relating to some things I found in the library, because I haven't found answers, and since you were there, you may know something about it. First question concerns the White House Communications Agency. Can you tell me anything about how that functioned and what its connection was with you as press secretary?
Well, it supplied our communication system for the entire White House operation, and also helped the press get lines and that sort of thing. Worked pretty closely with the telephone company in the Western Union.
So in other words, it primarily served an administrative function that you were in charge of White House.
No, I wasn't in charge of the. Got what they call it, WACA something. It was under the Signal Corps.
Okay.
I believe they were military people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a communication support operation for the White House.
Okay. These questions probably sound very mundane.
I think they were under the control of the White House military.
Okay.
Who most of that period was Colonel Cross.
Okay. These, I'm sure, it may sound like silly questions, but these are the things you are very rarely going to find in documents.
Yeah.
All right. Another question concerns this business of the videotape unit that was set up in the White House. I read that Frank Stanton gave a little bit of advice about it. It was set up in '66 in July, but I wondered if you ever had, if anybody talked with you or you gave any thought to this White House innovation of the Johnson era of having a machine that would videotape commercial television broadcasts while they were being broadcast?
No, I just accepted what they did. I didn't become press secretary until December
mm-hmm.
of that year, and it was already in place by the time I was there. I know I like the idea. I just took it as a matter of course. On anything mechanical or that supported what we were doing, I never paid much attention to it.
Okay.
I just took what they had.
For instance, did you ever watch anything that they might have taped an evening or a week before when you saw some reference someplace else for it? Or did you make almost no use of this stuff?
I didn't make much use of it. The president did.
Did he watch this pretty often?
I don't know. I think he watched programs like Issues and Answers and Meet the Press and the news type programs, the Sunday programs,
mm-hmm.
a good bit. When he missed the programs, he did it. I know he did that.
Yeah.
And I've seen some programs with him that were videotaped. I don't know, I've forgotten how many, but there were, I can remember, seemed to me mostly it was Sunday programming
mm-hmm.
that he might have missed because of church or something else.
Okay. One last question of this sort. There was a White House Naval Photographic Unit, as you know, produced
right.
monthly films in color. Now I saw
right.
some of these, the library.
Yeah.
Was this Lyndon Johnson's idea?
I have no idea.
Do you know whether anybody ever watched these films? Like, would the family sit and watch them once a month, or they produced
yeah,
a report?
They were. Some of them were. Let's see what he did. Of course, they were historical record films that were designed to go into the record of the administration.
Mm-hmm.
But he watched them each month, and a lot of his staff did, and occasionally he would. and along with other films that, that were done, like the USIA did a variety of films that he enjoyed looking at.
He'd get those USIA films in, to just to take a look at them, things they produced.
Right.
But I assume you never had any job like picking which ones. He'd had somebody else do that?
No.
Did he have anybody on his staff who was particularly involved with television? I've read some memos in the LBJ Library, very intelligent memos about television or a particular show and how it was covered, but I didn't know whether this was a typical thing or very atypical.
Well, different people at different times. Bob Kintner was there for a while, of course, been president of two networks, so he was acutely sensitive to it. And then Bob Fleming, who was my deputy, was a television person off the ABC staff, so he was a TV advisor. But the president, of course, was close to Frank Stanton and others outside the White House, who Guggenheim and others who were, I would imagine, gave him advice on it. But there on the White House staff, probably Fleming.
Okay.
Would be the best, and he still works in Washington. I think he works for Representative Abraham Kazin.
Well, that's easy enough to check. I'll give him a call just to see if he, or write him a letter first and see if he can remember a little bit. Now, something that I've gone through your oral history interview so that a couple questions are simply outgrowths of what I thought were some very interesting things you said 10 years ago. I don't expect that you remember exactly what you said, but one of the things that you talk about in that oral history interview is the fact that you think that, that Johnson, in effect, became too familiar with the press. He should have been more aloof. And people talk about this. Have you given any thought in retrospect to why Lyndon Johnson was so obsessed with what mass media thought about his policies and what he was up to?
Well, it's just in his nature. He had been a journalist of sorts himself, and worked on the school paper, and was interested in it, and was a good writer, and some of his closer acquaintances over the years were journalists, Bill White, Bob Kintner, Drew Pearson, and others, and it was just something that fascinated him. And he really all thought was too accessible in some ways. Familiarity breeds contempt, and he was just always available. And he sometimes sought the press to come and visit with him. Sometimes when they hadn't even asked to, that sort of thing. And that I just thought that for a president to be that, you know, this fine line between being accessible and being overexposed. And I thought that he subjected himself to a little too much exposure, which in turn led the press to blame him for a lot of things where blame could have been shifted somewhere else in the government. I mean, the more things you try to envelop, the more likely you are to catch a lot of the flack from the problems associated with certain things. He wanted his stamp on everything in the government virtually, and so when you take credit, you're also going to take receive some blame. I just thought he wasn't a he should have handled that better. But it was his nature. He was gregarious. He liked to be with the press. He liked to talk to reporters. He liked to have private interviews. And he just exposed himself too much, I think. Still do.
One of the things that interests me, and you talk about this in your interview, you mentioned that with the various papers that were available, and you mentioned which ones you really could get in Washington, that someone on the staff would make clippings. And you say, well, my problem was I get into work, I didn't have time to sit and read newspapers or clippings. I had a job to do all day. And yet we keep hearing about how Lyndon Johnson was obsessed with trying to find out stuff. And you mentioned that he really knew more about what various people were saying than anybody else did.
Yeah.
And my question is whether you ever formed an opinion, or have one now, as to whether Johnson got most of his information from a newspaper or from radio or from television, or whether he used all of them and just simply the more the merrier, or
it
whatever.
Was the more the merrier.
Okay.
And they have to throw in the congressional record. He read religiously read the congressional record every morning. Got it brought especially to his room about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning. And he read all the available daily papers very early in the morning before anybody else even got stirring. And he watched the network morning shows. So all of that combined, and then he'd turn on the hourly newscast. And then he had AP and UPI in his office. And I had a Reuters ticker. We had a Reuters ticker available to us too. So we were just constantly being peppered with news. He had more, obviously a lot of his staff people, including me, I read the papers in the car coming to work or at home before I came to work. But I didn't have access to the as many of the news broadcasts and things as he did. You just can't do it. You don't have time to do it. It's something he liked to do. You know, 7 o'clock in the morning, he liked to watch the news in his bed. Well, at 7 o'clock in the morning, I was trying to get to work, and he always said he had greater luxury for that kind of thing because he didn't have to get up and go to the office. So, but it was he got it from all those sources, not just one. He was amply informed of everything that went on.
I think maybe in retrospect, one of the most beloved images of Lyndon is his famous battery of three television sets.
Yeah.
And everybody that goes to the LBJ Library, the guards told me, and I watched myself how much people love that. Did he really sit and switch channels?
Sure.
I mean, like
he'd
virtually
watch all
every...
three. Well, he'd watch. Where the sets were set on the three networks, and he'd have the sound. What he'd do was move the sound from one to the other, depending on what was on the air. And I did the same thing. I had the same thing at home. The signal corps put one in my house at his instruction, so I could try to see all those morning programs, and also in my office I had one, so I could watch the evening news broadcasts and try to catch as much of it as I could. So he made sure that the key staff people also had the ability to see all three network news programs at one time. Otherwise, you just missed part of them.
Well, when you mention that, this reminds me of one other question I wanted to ask you. I had an interview with Harry McPherson, and he told other people too that when TET 68, the Vietnam crisis, came up at that time, that what he saw on television seemed more real than official reports. Now, Walt Rostow told me that he didn't think his job was to watch television, and he really claimed he didn't pay much attention. So my question is, you've told me something about your own situation. Do you remember any cabinet officers that, sort of like Rostow, that they really kind of disliked the whole idea of television, didn't watch it, or any like McPherson, who seemingly felt that what they were seeing on television was truer almost than what they got elsewhere?
Well, your frame of reference is different. Person to person. Harry probably didn't see as television as he thinks now that he saw, but at the time, Harry was quite concerned about us being in Vietnam, and he would naturally look at at Tet in a different light than someone who was knee-deep in the minute-to-minute handling of the situation, and whereas Harry would be appalled at what was happening during Tet. Someone who was handling cable traffic and military reports and everything else, like Rostow, would have a different perspective than Harry would. Most of what Harry was, I mean, Harry learned, he read the official report, sure, but not at the length and with the intensity that people in the Situation Room and the Security Council did. So his perspective would be somewhat different. on television I thought was true, but the accounts, the TV people were looking at it from the standpoint of the sensational happenings in Vietnam, whereas the others were trying to assess how much damage had been done, what was recoverable, what were the long-range effects, what was the military outcome of Tet. And so you can get two perspectives. It's obvious that Tet speeded up the American determination to move on out of Vietnam, and certainly had a great impact on public opinion in that direction and on the government. But from the people looking at it from the military standpoint, and the it was not as disastrous. It wasn't a defeat at all. You know, from the standpoint of those trying to handle the war, I think some of them were actually at the time amazed and delighted that the thing had held together as well as it did, and that the losses inflicted on the Viet Cong and the recovery of Hue and other places rather quickly showed that Tet had been a failure as an offensive by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. I mean, they looked at it as a failure, whereas most people in the country, the impact of television and the general coverage was it was a terrible defeat. Now, to someone like me, who honestly was trying to look at it objectively from the standpoint of how it impacted the public, and it was pretty obvious to me that the impact on the public of Tet was very detrimental to the president's war effort. But the impact on our military in Vietnam was considerably the other way. You know, it was quite a victory through their eyes. Well, and it's all in the eye of the beholder. You know, to me it appeared that if something like that could happen at that late date in Vietnam, that they could mount that type of operation, even though they were whipped. Just the mere fact that they could mount that type of operation was a very negative thing from our standpoint. And that's the way I looked at it, and I'm sure that's the way Harry looked at it.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. Well, when you bring up this now, one of the things that I have wondered about, Rostow's only one of the people who talked about this. Well, he thinks in retrospect he made a mistake that not going to the American people and help having Johnson speak more directly on a subject of what really was going on in Vietnam, that somehow, in retrospect, a mistake was made in not making the facts of the situation in those early months known. Is that your feeling?
Yes, a lot of it was before I got there, but I always had the impression that the president really didn't want Vietnam to crowd out everything else he was doing. And he deliberately pushed Vietnam into a position. He downplayed Vietnam, you know, to a large degree, because he had so much else he wanted to do and he had on his mind. And he didn't want a war to mess up his domestic programs, and he was determined to go ahead with full funding of everything that he wanted to do. And he just wasn't determined not to let the war disfigure his administration. And I think with that intent in mind, he tended not to, or at least in those early days, not to really try to sell the Vietnam War or something. You know, it was we were going to defend South Vietnam, and that was it. You know, it wasn't, he didn't try to rally the country or get emotional about it or anything like that. Possibly could never have. You know, it's conceivable to me that he rallied the country, but he did not call for sacrifice he did not impose certain rationing or whatever else to bring to the attention of the American people that we were really in a war. They really discovered we were in a war from watching guys get killed on television. That's really how they really soaked in that we're in one hell of a bloody war, because we didn't really treat it that way. We didn't treat it as an all-out war effort, and didn't make any move toward mobilizing the country or rallying the American people to a cause. He could have made some sort of crusade or cause out of it. I think it was the type of thing that would have been a very risky undertaking at best, but it was a, no question, it was a deliberate decision on his part that he just, he didn't have any desire to lead some sort of crusade in Vietnam. He wanted to do the job, stand by our commitment, but he didn't want it clouding everything else in the country. And in retrospect, a lot of people now, you hear it all over the place, that why didn't we go all out and get it out of the way, you know, go ahead and mobilize the country and call up the National Guard and do the things that make the people realize that we're in a war and then get it over with. Either get it over with or not ever go in, you know, is what you always hear now. Well, at the time, it appeared that we could handle the commitment without that sort of all-out effort, so that's the course he took. And I know a lot of the less hawkish advisors that he had in those days, and that includes Rostow, Rusk, McNamara, all of them who were always the hand of restraint on the military, that sometimes I'm sure they wake up in the night thinking, why in the hell didn't we just knock them flat and go on about our business instead of this prolonged slow bloodletting. And I think that's perfectly natural. I'm sure people involved in the Korean War think the same thing in retrospect. But at the time, it looked like the right thing to do. It's not drag the American people down the road into something that in some sort of all-out war effort or all-out war, for that matter. So,
do you ever remember either thinking in January and February '68 that, gee, I wish that my president would do something to sell this, you know, hit sort of his side of what's going on more vigorously? Did you ever talk to Johnson and urge that sort of thing, or do you view your duties?
No, I didn't, because frankly, at that point, I didn't think he could sell it. I was a strong advocate of Johnson not running again, and I didn't think that I thought the country was so divided that he was not doing himself or the country any favors by running for re-election, and that even if he were elected, it would be increasingly difficult to govern the country, and that the people were ready for a change, some change in direction, and that it was too late by then to try to mount some sort of public opinion offensive. I don't think it would have succeeded. No, I never advocated anything like that. I don't believe it would have worked.
Okay, I have one question I was going to ask you, because see just what you thought of it. I think it's not very original. It seems to me that now, already, this funny way that just get a little time elapses and things look very differently, that there's a lot more interest and sympathy for Lyndon Johnson now than there was. And that we've got all kinds of people now that weren't even old enough to know what was going on in '68. Have you given any thought to why Lyndon Johnson seems more interesting as a figure now than he did 10 years ago?
Because he was a strong president, and obviously a national leader of some depth and breadth. And all three presidents we've had since then have not shown the kind of pizzazz that he did. I mean, it's comparing him with other people. And recognizing that Johnson confronted problems and tried to do something about it, and had knowledge of dealing with Congress, knew how to get programs passed. He was an interesting person, personality, and he had there was meat on his bones. I've heard a lot of journalists, foreign and domestic say that over the past 10 years, that the blood ran in his veins. You know, he was a tough old hombre, and I think that's now being appreciated, that you can have a very active, aggressive president who gets things done. And that's why he looks better. And in 10 more years, he'll look even better. He'll have a Truman rebirth. It's already happening, and it'll continue to happen. People will overlook all the reasons they had for not liking him, and they'll start saying, well, hell, he's kind of an Andrew Jackson, 1960s style. And he'll look better and better as time goes on, I think.
All right, let me ask you a question about this Walter Cronkite special. And your secretary told me when I talked to her last week you didn't remember too much, so let me
about
just
what?
Mention that Walter Cronkite went to Vietnam and came back and broadcast an hour special on Vietnam, February 27th, 1968.
Right.
Now, William Small, in his book, To Kill a Messenger, has a footnote where he says that you told him, and this would have been around 69, 70, the book came out about 70, that Lyndon Johnson had watched that program and said, in effect, well, my goodness, if Walter Cronkite is turning against me, this is where Cronkite came out against the war in Vietnam, I'm, in effect, losing Middle America. Now, do you recall whether...
I don't recall telling Small that. I told David Halberstam that later on. It was used in his book the other day, but, I mean, recently. Mm-hmm. The Johnson did talk about Cronkite going to Vietnam and, in effect, turning against the war. And it did worry him immensely that that Cronkite had in effect become dovish, because he saw the impact was going to be tremendous on the country. Now, whether or not Johnson saw that program at X time and that sort of thing, I don't know. He saw newscasts, other things. I'm sure that at Johnson's bound to have seen the program. I remember being with Johnson when he saw a commentary from Cronkite. Now, whether it was on the morning news, I think it probably was on the morning CBS morning news, where it might have been an excerpt out of the program or something. I saw the programs. I either saw them at home or I saw the videotapes. I don't remember.
Well, this particular program...
I don't know whether he saw... I'm pretty sure he saw all the programs in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember precisely. I know that we talked about the Cronkite program, and he was very concerned about Cronkite coming home from Vietnam and portraying the cause is lost, in effect, as the impact it was going to have. Now, when it was and where it was, I don't really have a clear recollection.
Okay, well, what you
understand from since then that there wasn't any way he was gone somewhere, could not have seen the original program, so I don't know.
But it was definitely, I mean, I've the only reason I do this is, you know, one of the problems sometimes is people remember things, but sometimes detailed records will
not
suggest
sure.
Won't support it. Now, in this case, I was interested in this one thing because of Halberstam, and because this is it's interesting. So I looked into this, and LBJ had to give speeches on that night. He was in Austin, came back late. But the show was videotaped by that White House unit, and there's no reason he couldn't have seen it in the next few days.
No, I'm almost positive he saw it.
And that's fine with me. My personal perspective, I'm delighted, but I'm interested in how television has had some impact on the way policy gets made. But you don't want to make claims you can't support.
No, that's right.
But
and I think it's overstated. You know, everybody's jumped on this. Small did, and I guess that's why Halberstam used it too, because it appears that television, you know, that Cronkite had such a major role in changing national policy or something. Well, I don't buy that. That didn't quite happen that way. It it was a serious thing for the president, because he respected Cronkite himself. I think it had as much impact on the president as the attitudes of Dean Acheson and others. I'll put it that way.
And I think that's quite a significant statement.
Yeah.
One of the things that McPherson brought up, I hadn't asked him about this, was that he said that Johnson did respect Cronkite, and he sort of thought that Brinkley was a smart aleck.
Right.
And I wonder if you could say anything, your impressions of how Johnson, what he thought about the commentators who were on the air in 68, or particularly the chief ones, Cronkite and then Huntley Brinkley.
Well, I don't think he had any. Brinkley, he apparently had a run-in with sometime before I got there. I don't think he had an overly high opinion of Brinkley, but I never heard him criticize any of the rest of them. I've forgotten who was doing the NBC News at that time. I guess Chancellor was back with NBC.
No, Huntley Brinkley were on in
68. Oh, that's
right.
Huntley Brinkley was on in. Frank Reynolds went on up to the... I know he had a high opinion of Frank Reynolds. And then Peter Jennings, I guess, had the ABC News part of that time. I don't remember.
Yeah, well, that's...
I don't remember which ones were actually on at that time. I know of all of them. Of course, he and Cronkite were friends, and he particularly was concerned about CBS. He always recognized CBS as the leading news network and the most powerful influence. He felt they were the most powerful influence, so naturally he felt the Cronkite would be the most powerful influence.
One other question here. How did you get your job as press secretary? I know you've gone into this before. I just wanted to ask you once again.
Well, I don't know. I didn't ask to be press secretary. I didn't apply for the job, so I don't know how I got it. I was recruited to come to Washington in early 66 with no intention of being, or no hint that I was going to be press secretary, although I certainly thought that he might be looking me over for that place because I knew Bill wanted to leave. And then when he asked me to eventually, after I was working with Rostow some, he asked me to help Bill and become sort of part of the press office without having any title. Well, I also, of course, was aware that he was going to try to groom me for the place, but he never did tell me he was. And then later, when Bill and the president talked it through, Bill recommended me for the place. So when he asked me if I wanted it, I said, yeah. That's the way it went.
A question which interests me because it's hard to find details on it. And subject to cartoons and photographs, did Johnson ever talk with you or say anything about any cartoons that he particularly liked or disliked? Same thing about
Yeah, but mostly he dealt with Willie Day Taylor on that. He worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't pay much attention to cartoons.
And the same
Willie,
thing on...
Willie Day was the cartoon expert.
Okay. How about on photographs? So you didn't pay much attention to that?
Oh, I did, but you know, I don't remember anything specifically that he liked to have his pictures made in certain ways, and he enjoyed looking at photographs, picking out ones he liked, giving them away, or saving them, or whatever he wanted to do with them. He had tons of pictures taken.
You never remember him talking about any of the, like that photograph that. Of General Loan blowing the brains out of a Viet Cong sympathizer. He ever
no.
say anything about that?
Not that I remember.
And you don't...
I'm sure he did, but I'm sure he didn't like it, but I don't remember specifically.
And other than that, how about, do you recall, like, do you remember watching, it's kind of incredible when you see it in retrospect, but who knows what it was like at the time, but, you know, that NBC actually had this damn footage. They had a camera crew, so you not only see the sympathizer
yeah.
fall down, but then the blood spurt out of his head. Do you
yeah.
remember seeing that?
Yeah, I remember seeing it. I don't know whether I saw it at the time or saw it later. But I remember seeing footage of the killing, just like I remember seeing footage of the raising the flag on Iwo Jima, which everybody thinks is a still photograph, and it was actually a movie, too.
There's an interesting statement that LBJ made to Cronkite in one of those post-presidential interviews. He said, talking to Cronkite, he said, you guys have ruined politics. TV has changed politics, and no more city machines. Do you think that's true? I'm trying to get, you know, some way what, how television, if in any way, has affected the way we run our politics in this country. Have you given any thought to that, or LBJ
no.
talked to you about it?
No, I really haven't. I'm telling you, I'm getting in such a bind now on a 4 o'clock meeting away from the office that I'm going to have to wrap it up.
Well, that's fine. In fact, I'll tell you what, I will let you go at this point. I want to tell you how much I appreciate you taking this time right at this moment. When are you going to get back from your...
I'll be back in about 2 weeks.
Okay. Well, I think this takes care of my questions, and
okay,
I appreciate
else,
very much.
Give me
yeah.
a call. I'll be here. I'll still be here tomorrow. I'm not leaving until Wednesday, so
okay.
if you think of anything else, give me a call.
Well, thank you very much
okay.
for your time. Bye.
Yes, sir.